It's time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here with Money, Riches, and Wealth, here with Bombom Vasuto Tommaso. How are you?
I'm doing great. I made it.
Yeah, I know. It's a mess out there, isn't it? Baltimore Beltway is a mess.
Yes,
so we have a guest tonight. He's only going to be able with us for a half hour, but his new book coming out is going to be quite interesting.
Yes.
He's got quite an opinion on lots of different things, so tell us who it is and we'll get right to it, Tom.
Yeah, well, the name of the book is called Trumped, and it is about Donald Trump and our nation, but it says A Nation on the Brink of Ruin and How to Bring It Back. The author is with us tonight. His name is David Stockman, and some people may recognize that name if you've been around. He was the director of office management and budget for President Reagan.
Yeah.
But he also spent time on Wall Street, and he's got some opinions about where we are as a nation. So
that's true. Well, anyway, David, are you with us?
I am very happy to be with you.
All right. Well, great.
Welcome.
And you know, Tom says the book's about Trump, but actually it's not. It's just about why did Donald Trump come onto the scene? What is it about our country that's going on? So, David, I guess the first thing I want to address is the whole concept of the central banks, the Greenspans, the Bernankes, the Yellen, and what they're doing to this country and their policies and where it's taken our country. You have a lot to say about this book. It's over 500 pages. So why don't you give us your what you see happening with our central banks?
Okay, well, I think that's a great question. And I should say that, you know, the important part in the title is the brink of ruin.
Yes, that
and,
is true.
The brink of ruin really focuses right in on the central bank, on this massive money printing stimulation policy that we've had from the Fed, not just since the crisis in 2008, but really for the last several decades.
Yeah, they called it the Greenspan put, is what they used to term it, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of aspects to it. One of it is the adoption during the Greenspan period of something called wealth effects management of the economy. And the theory was that if they could just pump the stock market high enough and keep it high enough and put a safety net under it, that's what we mean by the put, then, you know, the public, at least those that own stock, would feel wealthier, feel more confident, their bullish enthusiasms, animal spirits would run. That would lead to spending and investment and, you know, the whole ball of wax in terms of the Keynesian model of the economy. Well, I think that is so wrong-headed. It's proven to be a dangerous route. Twice now already this century we had the dot-com bust, and it caused a massive setback in the economy. Trillions were lost by the Main Street households who believed it. And what they did, and then we can go on from there, is they doubled down after the housing bubble finally collapsed and the stock market hit the tank in September 2008. They doubled down and, you know, tripled or quadrupled the rate of money printing over the next 4 or 5 years. They've now created an even more fantastic, unsustainable bubble. And I think we're on the verge of that whole thing coming apart. So that's why I say ruin. And I think it doesn't really matter which candidate is elected, because we're going to have a market crash and a recession sometime in the next year.
So let's just go back to what you're referring to. So in an economy, if central banks, since we're in a fiat economy, which means there's nothing to the money they print, they just can print it at will. And when they overproduce money, it has to go somewhere. So in the late 1990s, it was going to all these fantastic companies that were supposedly worth trillions of dollars almost. And people got overenthusiastic about companies that said, we're going to do something like this, .com. We're not sure. And next thing you know, they're paying hundreds of millions of dollars for the stock. And that's an example. And then in the late 2000s, you know, a house that's worth, you know, maybe $200,000-$300,000. People are bidding $400,000-$500,000 for it. People didn't even have the money to pay for it. We're bidding that kind of money. And that's what you're saying is happening when a central bank overproduces money.
Yeah, and there's a new angle on it that I think is important to understand, and that is we've had this massive expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. That means every time it goes, it expands by a dollar, it buys a treasury bond or bill or Fannie Mae mortgage-backed security. It's conjuring out of thin air new credit that flows into Wall Street. In other words, Wall Street hands over a bond, and they credit Goldman Sachs' bank account with another, let's say, $100 million, if that's the transaction. Then that $100 million, allegedly, is going to flow into the economy, but it doesn't when you're at a condition of peak debt, which I think we are throughout the mainstream or flyover America part of our economy that I talk about in the book. In other words, households borrowed so much for 20 years leading up to the housing crash and the credit crisis of 2008 that they now are fully loaded with debt. There has been a little expansion of debt in the auto sector, and that's about ready to hit the hit the wall, I think, and a huge expansion in the student loan sector, but, you know, those are going to be massive treasury write-offs soon. Other than that, household debt was about $14 trillion at the time of the crisis in September 2008, $14.2 trillion to be exact. It's $14.3 trillion today. They can't borrow anymore. So then what happens is that all of this new credit produced by the Fed as it engages in QE, you know, 1, 2, 3, etc., never leaves the canyons of Wall Street. It pushes the interest rate on overnight money down to the so-called zero bound. When you do that, you are, you are creating the speculators' afternoon delight, so to speak, because they can buy bonds, they can buy stocks, they can position in the options market and carry those asset positions with almost no cost, 25 basis points, or right now it's 38 basis points. It's a rounding error. So what it is sort of jet fuel for speculation, and that's essentially why the markets have come up off the bottom at, say, 670 on the S&P 500 in the March bottom to, 2150 plus or minus today.
David, you have to hold on with me because I got to take a quick traffic break, and then I'm going to come right back to you, and we'll get into more about why you see what's coming in the future. But right now, I got to take this traffic pause. We'll be right back. Money, Riches, Wealth, and David Stockman.
Personal financial management is a comprehensive approach to combating these issues, and the financial physical is the first step. This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate, an independent, fee-only firm. The financial physical begins with an objective analysis of your personal finances and ends with a plan to help achieve your goals. Experience the difference of the financial physical and learn how personal financial management can revolutionize your financial well-being. To learn more about the financial physical and the other services we offer, call us at 410-823-SAVE. That's 410-823-7283. Or the easy way to remember that, 410-823-SAVE. Or visit us online at DrewTig.com. That's DrewTig.com.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're with David Stockman. Is sort of, we call him the budget director under Reagan, I guess is a good way to say that. And his book, Trumped, is coming to market soon. And it's A Nation on the Brink of Ruin and How to Bring It Back. David, Ray Dalio of Bridgewater Associates said many times recently in interviews that he believes we're on the late cycle of a super debt, super debt cycle, which happens every 80 or 90 years in a country, and he thinks we're on the later end of that. You sort of lining up with that. The one thing is, David, Ray Dalio says that, you know, you can never predict when it's going to ultimately end. It can go on a lot longer, even though you think it should be over soon. So why do you say, next 12 months or so?
Well, I agree with both points. One, we're in a massive debt cycle. In fact, you can't say it happens every 80 years because we've never had anything this big in recorded financial history. We have never had central banks all over the world engaged in a coordinated process of credit expansion that is truly monumental if you look at it. But in brief, 20 years ago, there was about $40 trillion of debt in the world. There's $225 trillion of debt, public and private, household, business, governments around the world today. A huge increase in the debt burden relative to GDP. You know, debt increased by something like $185 trillion over those two decades. The world's GDP grew by only a small fraction of that. So he's right. Secondly, I do believe you can't predict exactly what the catalyst will be. The only thing I know is that as you get later and later into both a business cycle, and now we're in month 90 since the recession ended in June of 2009, and as you get deeper into the credit cycle, the risk that an unsuspecting, unexpected event or black swan or whatever term you want to use will catalyze a sell-off that creates, you know, downward momentum that can't be stopped. The risk of that rises very rapidly with the passage of time. So, you know, he might be right that it could happen 2 years from now, not 2 months from now. But I think there's plenty of signs around that we're kind of at the end of the road here, including the fact that all the central banks of the world are now becoming confused and running out of dry powder. The ECB is about ready to have a big fight about extending their massive money printing program because the Germans realize it's killing savers in their banks. And politically, that is not going down well in Germany at all. In the United States, the last meeting of the Fed was divided. Open Market Committee was divided 9-3. As we get deeper into this period of zero or near zero interest rates, the level of disagreement and tension is going to rise. We're going to be in month 90 right now of interest rates essentially, except for a rounding error, at zero. There's nothing like that in recorded history. They know better than this at the Fed, but they've now kind of created their own monster. They're petrified of a stock market sell-off, and so they dither and delay making up one excuse after another to get off, to not get off the zero bound. But the thing is, if you think about it, 8 years, and we're almost there, of zero-cost money is the same thing as an eight-year bond that has no yield. Now, what sense does that make? It's not, you know, it's not rational. It's not sustainable. It defies every canon of sound finance that ever existed until a few years ago. And as a result of that, even the Fed is going to, you know, have its moment of reckoning.
Hey, David, yeah. So we don't have much time. I wanted to get to this also.
Sure.
You clearly say in your book, and I agree with you, but I'm just going to give you the party line, the government line, is that Bernanke and Yellen have saved the world. They saved the economy. Draghi saved the economy. So who are you to be out there saying that these guys who saved the world from this incredible catastrophe, that they're wrong?
Well, they're wrong because you can't get something for nothing in massive proportions forever. And that's what's happened now. The balance sheet of the Fed was $800 billion when Bernanke, panicked when Lehman folded, went bankrupt in September 2008. It's now $4.5 trillion, so there's been a five-fold expansion in a very short period of time. That is basically financial fraud, because what it did was delay the correction that was necessary in our economy and financial markets, scooped up $3.5 trillion worth of bonds with money made by, hitting the button on the electronic printing press, and that has done nothing except kick the can down the road and create a false, reflation of the financial bubble which means that the next time it's going to crash even harder. And the next time, I doubt whether the Fed is going to be in a position to do anything about it, because it's already got interest rates at zero. If it tries to go to negative, I think there'll be a massive Trumpian revolt by the savers and wage earners and businessmen, small business people of America. And if they try to go to a huge QE program, they're going to scare the hell out of the financial markets, because they said the last one solved the whole problem, or, as you say, saved the world. Well, if it didn't, and we have another crash and another recession, I think it's Katie bar the door. The credibility of the central banks of the world, and the Fed in particular, is going to be shattered by what lies ahead in the next year or two. And as a result of that, we will find that they didn't save the world in the fall of 2008. They actually laid the planking for an even bigger disaster than the one that was underway.
So you mean we won't call Greenspan maestro anymore, nor Bernanke the savior of the world anymore? Is that what you're trying to tell
me?
You know what's really funny, David, is that, you know, they're out there talking about banks that are too big to fail, and they keep saying, we can't let you get too big to fail and so forth. Well, the market was ready to take care of that in 2008. They were going to make sure that these banks were no longer too big to fail, because it was going to let them fail and resurrect a much more sound banking system than the one we have.
You are spot on, and that's the one of the many errors of this whole false system that we have underway. You can't have capitalism, particularly capitalism in the financial markets, if you don't have the opportunity to fail as well as succeed, if you don't have periodic cleansing of excesses that generate out of the animal.
Here we go, Mike's on.
Normal people and traders and gamblers, and if you don't have a two-way market where the people, where the skeptics can short whatever the gamblers are buying. But in this market that is so rigged and falsified by the central banks, we've killed off all the short sellers for all practical purposes. It's a one-way market. It's a no-brainer trade. And so the speculators just come in, buy stuff because it's going up, borrow money to fund it, and hope that the bubble just keeps on expanding. That's the kind of distorted, perverted market, so-called market, I call it a casino, that has resulted from the fundamental thing you raise, and that is stopping the cleansing that was going on in the fall of 2008. By the way, in my last book called The Great Deformation, I went into that 100 pages worth of depth, 100 pages worth of analysis to show that when they said we were facing, you know, a 100-year flood, the financial system was going to flush down a black hole, that we had to violate all the rules, or as even Bush said back then, we got to set the free market aside in order to save it, silly things like that. It just wasn't true. The meltdown would have burned out in the canyons of Wall Street. Most of the big bad actors were down already. Merrill Lynch was down. Bear Stearns was gone. Lehman went under. In a few weeks, Goldman would have been gone. Morgan Stanley would have been gone. And that would have been the end of it. It wasn't going to create some kind of black plague, financial contagion that was going to take down the whole economy.
Not to mention the people that caused this mess would have gone in their comeuppance, and that's what should have happened. They strut around now like they're some superheroes, like Jamie Dimon. He made a lot of mistakes. He should have been punished.
That's exactly the point. What I said in my book is the world would have little noted or long remembered the passing of Goldman Sachs. There would have been bankruptcies, there would have been huge losses, the stock of all these gamblers would have been worth zero, the enablers would have had big losses. By that I mean the people who bought the paper and the especially the subordinated long-term debt that allowed these Wall Street houses to develop multi-trillion balance sheets, if you can imagine that. But my point was that once those institutions went down, then the parts and pieces would have been reorganized. There may have been, you know, five sons of Goldman, one in asset management, another one as a, you know, underwriter, a third one in the M&A business and so forth. But it would have been run by chastened people who had a real live near-death experience financially with what happens when you gamble too much, you lever too much, you mismatch your balance sheet too much between short-term hot money overnight and long-term sticky, illiquid, risky assets.
David.
All of that, you know, would have been, that would have been, the decks would have been cleared on that, and we would be in a different world
right.
today.
David, I promised you I'd only hold you for a half hour. I'm at the half-hour mark here. I really appreciate your time. And
okay.
I hope we can get together again and talk more
yeah,
about this.
Very good. There's a lot to talk about. You've really raised some great questions, and appreciate the chance to be with you.
All right, David. Thank you for your time. We're going to take a pause. This is Money, Riches, and Wealth. We'll be right back.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
I guess that was on purpose. Really? Yeah, well, you know.
I like that.
I didn't. So we just interviewed David Stockman with his upcoming book, Trumped, he
yeah.
calls it. And it's really not a statement for or against Trump. It's
right.
not a statement for or against Hillary. He just says that either one gets elected, they're just going to be walking into a disaster. They have no clue what they're walking into and have no clue what they ought to be doing. You know, he does talk about some things that he thinks ought to be done to help improve the economy. He actually, there one page there, page 31, he thought that Trump would probably be the only one that would be logically even open to the idea of doing what needs to be done, but he then quickly says that he doesn't think he would ever do anything logical either. So
right. Well, the question is, can the president do it by themselves and without
no.
you know without the rest of the Congress? And yeah, I mean, he lays out 10 great deals for the Donald, you know, things that he could do, you know, some of which I would agree with, but can he do them? Can any president by themselves do it without the support of the rest of the, you know,
right.
The
and, you know, and I think the key here is that, you know, people like Stockman write these books and they got to be somewhat sensationalized what they're talking about. And, you know, they make people fearful, you know, and, I don't think what he's saying in here from the way we look at things is not fearful. It's just, you know, you want to look at the logic of what's going on
mm-hmm.
and you got to think up a logical response as
right.
to, well, how am I going to position myself? You know, and a lot of people, need to realize that the stock market tends to over time benefit from almost any type of economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the only economy that it wouldn't benefit from would be like the 1930s, which is an outright deflation where everything you own is cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So in other words, a bottle of Coca-Cola is $1 one day and it's 90 cents the next day and it's 80 cents the next day and it's 70 cents. And they keep having to sell it cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. That's the only type of economy that's not going to benefit from, the stock market won't benefit from. And Japan has proved that. They've had a 40,000 on the Nikkei
right.
in 1990, Tom.
Yeah.
1990,
yeah.
40,000. Today it closed at, what, 16.5 or something
yeah.
like that?
Yeah.
That's still well over 50% down.
26 years. Yeah.
26 years, you
yeah.
know? And why is it? Because yeah. Japan has gone through a constant dripping of what used to cost $1 one day is down to 90 cents 5 years later, down to 80 cents 5 years after that, down to 75 cents a few years after that, and has continued to do that for 26 years. And that's why their stock market is no longer is unable to respond.
Right. Yeah. And over time, you know, stocks are a good place to be. But as he points out a little bit, is that we've taken some of the volatility out of the markets by, you know, feeding with, you know, low rates and, you know, really pushing people into the markets. And we haven't had those serious corrections that you need to have so that not everybody's there. And, you know, because you don't get something for nothing.
No.
And, you know, and so you may get higher rates over time, but you take more risk in periods of time. And I think your points are is that, You know, people need to look at these times not through a lens of fear, but through a lens of rationality of, okay, what do I have? Where am I going? You know, what risk can I take? Which risk should I not take?
And what type of economy is likely to evolve out of this? Mm-hmm. And the answer is that central banks continue to say we are going to produce inflation. That type of market has always, always been the number one environment for the stock market. Mm-hmm. There is no doubt about it. An inflationary environment in any country in the world that you ever study has had inflation. The stock market has benefited from it. Period.
Right. Yeah, and the question is can they control it? You know, and you know, they're trying to keep this, you know, 2% level of inflation, and then they're going to raise rates and adjust. And there's just so many ripple effects that, you know, the question has it gotten beyond their control?
Yeah, well, you know, there's no doubt, and he makes this point very clear, and that is you're down to 1% on 1.7% on the 10-year mm-hmm, treasury mm-hmm. and 0.25 on the 3-month treasury,
yeah.
And Europe's in negative interest rates, and and Japan is in negative interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a downturn of the economy. What does the central bank always do when you have a downturn in the economy?
They cut rates.
They cut rates. Well, how do you cut rates if you're already cut to the bloody bottom?
Right, right. Well, that's where they went into QE, the, you know, the quantitative easing. They started buying bonds, you know. And so his point is that, you know, the debt has risen so high that now if they raise rates on all of this debt, then their debt servicing is going to get out of control. So we got Social Security is going to be out of control. Medicare is out of control. And then you get debt servicing out of control. And then what are they going to do? They raise taxes. What's the cycle going to be?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was looking at it the other day. The federal budget is something like 3.1 or 3.2 trillion. And we have what? Almost 20 trillion in debt outstanding. But what do you think the interest payment on $20 trillion is, Tom? It's $225 billion. It's all we're spending on interest right now to service that $20 billion. And that's because they have interest rates down at 0.75% and a quarter of a percent.
Yep.
The most they're paying is on a 10-year or a 30-year at 2% or 1.7%.
Right.
You don't have to pay a lot of interest if you're borrowing. And you know, what they're doing is they're servicing a lot of the debt on the short end of the curve. So it's especially cheap to them.
Yep.
And so you're absolutely right. If you get interest rates going up to 2% on the 3-month treasury and 4% on the 10-year, now you're talking about $600-800 billion to service $20 trillion in debt.
Yeah.
And so that's why inflation is the logical concept. But the key here is that the people who go around and pretend that gold and silver are an inflation hedge are absolutely wrong, because if all of a sudden they find five more mines out there and they're able to get into that gold and silver and start pumping tons and tons of silver and gold on the market, or if the price of silver and gold go up to 2,000 an ounce again and silver goes back up to 50 an ounce and people start bringing their silverware out and their gold jewelry out and selling it because they think this is a great way to make money, I can assure you it is not going to be an inflation hedge.
Right.
It is a supply and demand. All investments are supply and demand.
Right.
Supply and demand. Gold and silver are no different. Anyway, we've got to take another pause for traffic, and we'll be right back. Money, riches, and wealth. We strive to serve as a leader in educating the public on personal finance topics through our Financial Pulse and Consulate Journal. For these publications and learn about our personal financial management services, visit our website at DrewTigg.com, DrewTigg.com, and follow us on Twitter at TheFinCon for educational updates.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
And we're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We were talking with David Stockman, and we're just kind of wrapping up what we heard there and just, you know, discussing some of the issues. But one of the things I wanted to also talk about is that a couple weeks ago we did an interview with Wade Fowle.
Yeah.
And Wade really gave a honest, fair, assessment of all these annuities that you're hearing about paying you a bonus, and you know they supposedly make 7% rates of return, and all these kind of false you know, claims that they're making. And Wade is a doctor, a PhD in retirement income from the American College. The American College is the head of education for the insurance industry. You know, that's always been their you know, main
their
body
audience,
of education is for insurance agents. And
yeah, your CLUs and all those
kinds
of
things. And that's where those designations come from, the American College. And the annuities are insurance products. And so here is the doctor, the PhD, the head education guy for the American College coming on our show and doing a very fair and honest interview about what these annuities are, what they're really offering, and that what you're hearing and what you think you're hearing is a total misrepresentation of what you're really getting.
Right.
And there are a lot of better ways to do that, and we're going to have him back on sometime in about three or four more months to really talk about what are the strategies he believes people should be looking at to secure their retirement and so forth. And you can still get that podcast on our website, right?
Exactly.
It's on our, it's in our education center.
Yeah, you go to financialconsulate.com, and the top right-hand side is our education center, and then you go to Money, Riches, and Wealth, and it's the October 5th show that we did with Wade Fowle. You can also get it out on, you know, iTunes. We've got podcasts out there, so if you just Google
Money,
Riches,
Riches,
and
Wealth.
You know, you can find that October 5th show and listen to that.
Yep, and it's a great impartial, unbiased interview.
Unpaid.
About, unpaid, unorchestrated.
That's right.
We didn't tell what we were going to talk about. We just did an impromptu interview.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's go see what Bob wants. Bob in Lutherville, how can we help you?
Yes, I was listening to the earlier portion of the show with David Stockman, and I do remember when he was the financial guy with Reagan. Didn't he come up with voodoo economics, or was that or something about some of the Reaganomics? But anyway, what I was calling about
that was the other side that said that about him and Arthur Laffer. So,
right.
But yeah,
okay.
But go ahead. Yep.
I know you don't have much time, but I was listening to him, and I pretty much made back and done pretty well with all the after 08 and 09, and I'm trying to figure at 66. With my 401 and my regular investments, what did you get into it? Because I had to talk to the radio a little bit with what he recommended, since he says it's going to be a huge crash and he's
that's what he says.
Gloom and doom.
Right.
That's what he says. You know, I don't necessarily know. I mean, our opinion is always when we feel the risk reward ratio is starting to get long in the tooth, as you might say. And, you know, some form of correction could be upcoming. We just move some money off the table, but it's impossible to predict when these things are coming, so you can't take it all off. So if you tend to favor a 60-40 allocation, you might want to go down to 50-50 or 45-55.
I'm about 60-40.
But is that where you tend to stay?
More towards bonds, right? Right.
Is that where you tend to want to be, a 60-40, or is that just where you are now because you're...
That's probably where I think I probably should be, because I'm getting more and more conservative after everybody getting burnt.
So if that's true, then you know, you could probably take another 10 or 15% off the table and just sit back and wait. And, you know, knowing that if you're wrong, the worst-case scenario is that you're not going to make the total market rate of return. But if you're right, and the market does make a big correction, that's 15% or 20% more that you can plow back into the market at low points, and more than likely see it rise again. Because I would disagree with him that the world's coming to an end. I don't believe in that in any way, shape, or form.
But you still don't know what's going to happen in the short term.
One last question. Maryland tax-free bonds, state, local, and federal, no taxes on those. And if they constantly over a 15-20 year period paid about 5%, do you see anything that wouldn't be kind of conservative but pretty stable about that aspect?
Well, Maryland bonds, I don't think, are yielding more than 1.5 to 2.5%.
Yeah,
are they, Tom?
Yeah, you're not going to see the 5% necessarily, and obviously
every individual bonds.
Yeah, and you got to be each individual bond is a little different too. You got to look at whether it's a government obligation bond or if it's a revenue bond, and you know, the different kind of bonds that are out there. So, you know, you don't want to buy one bond. And I think really what happens is
I'd be a bond fund, I was told.
Yeah, well, you know, and the bond funds are okay as well. There's some good, you know, Maryland bond funds. There's some good national bond funds. You know, Maryland's a very highly rated state, so the yields tend to be a little lower. If you get a good manager with a national bond fund, you can usually pick up a little bit more yield. You still get the federal, you know, tax benefits of that, assuming your tax rates are such that, you know, that's really going to help you. And right now, you know, municipal bonds have been a pretty good relative to treasuries. So, yeah, I think, you know, the point that Drew's making is you got to look at your whole picture as well. You know,
okay, well, I took up enough of your time. Thank you for your help. I'll listen to you next week.
All right.
Take care. So he had to go.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I mean, I think the challenge, you know, we were talking about it earlier, you know, people get caught up with fear, and that drives decisions. And fear should not drive your decisions, neither should greed. You know, so you talked about the annuities. That's tapping into people's greed, right? You know, fear is the stuff like this where people are concerned about the markets. You know, don't have your mortgage payment in the stock market, and you might probably don't want to have your retirement money in a cash account entirely. You know, so there's a balance in there, and you've got to look at your whole picture and how it all fits together. And I think that's the challenge that people have.
Okay, we've got one more call coming in. This is about the last call we'll be able to take tonight, so we'll see if we can help them. Dave in Cockeysville, how can we help you? Dave?
Comments on the $300 million worth of municipal bonds. They're general obligation bonds that Kevin Kamenetz is going to issue. And they're on the ballot question or borrowing ordinance B through K. And the concern I have is if the economy continues to slow, raising taxes is the method they're going to use to pay for these bonds. I'm very concerned about that.
I almost always vote against those, especially the ones that I consider to be superfluous, you know.
I do, too. I mean, you know, I think I'm the only one. I thought I was the only one that voted against them because they always pass.
You know, well, that's because, you know, so few people ever do vote on them, and so they get usually passed,
well,
you know.
Well, four is the first box. Against is the second box.
I spoke with Warren Devereux this morning about it, who works at the state, and he's advising the state to slow down on their muni bond borrowing. And, you know,
that ain't going to happen.
There's a transparency problem here because the public is being forced to accept these bonds. And if the economy slows down, we got to pay the cost. And that's in the county charter. It's in the state charter. I don't think that's right.
See, Dave, here's the thing to think about with the state of Maryland. I only have 1 minute, okay? You look at any economy in the country that has ever run into hard time, like Texas, when the oil industry collapsed. Why did Texas run into hard time? Because they were dependent on oil. And Michigan, which was dependent on the auto industry and manufacturing and so forth. So when that turned down, Michigan and Detroit, especially Detroit and the surrounding areas, got hit hard. You know, so what is the industry that Maryland is dependent on? And you know the answer to it, don't you? Government. Government. That's the industry of Maryland. Government. Most Marylanders either work for the state, the counties, the school boards, and predominantly the federal government, or they work for a contractor for the federal government. If the federal government ever had to slow down its spending, Maryland would be in serious trouble because this state has made us dependent on government. And so I think that's the problem. We got to run, Dave. Sorry I can't follow up with you on that one. Mm-hmm. But anyway, David Stockman, good interview.
Yeah.
It's a good book. You ought to look into it. And it's a lot of good points going on in there. But tonight, we're finished for the night, Thomas. And so this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.